Lots to do on the show today. In a little bit, we're going to be talking with Edna Jacqueline Vasquez. She's an ultra marathoner that has just done some crazy, crazy superhuman stuff and run like 4 ultra marathons in the 4 desert series. I cannot even fathom doing that, but she's going to be in here next hour, and we're going to be talking with her all about that. But right now, we have 2 special guests in the studio. Nora Gruenberg and Crystal Pruitt are here. They're from New Leaders Council, and Nora is the co-director of the Chicago chapter, and Crystal is the diversity chair for the New Jersey chapter. Welcome to the program. Glad to have you here.
Thanks for having us, Amy.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. It's great.
Welcome, welcome. Welcome. So tell us about New Leaders Council. Nora, I know you've been on the show before and talked to us in advance of an event you did middle of last year, I think. But tell us, for those who don't know about the organization, a little bit about what you do.
All right. So New Leaders Council is a national nonprofit organization. We are nonpartisan, and we have the mission to recruit, train, and promote young progressives from all sectors. We are dedicated to sort of rallying around our shared progressive values like social justice, taking down racism, sexism, and helping to give and empower people to make changes in their communities. And with 44 chapters across the nation, we are, you know, growing every year and even make friends with other chapters, which is why our wonderful friend Crystal is here with us this evening.
Hey, girl.
She came to visit for New Year's, thought she'd give Chicago a whirl for New Year's Eve, and thanks for the surprise for having us on the radio show tonight. That was just the cherry on top.
Gladly, gladly. So as you're working with young leaders, how are you defining young? Like, what age group are we talking about here?
That actually is a very interesting question, because there's not a specific age range. It's what we're really looking for is sort of mid-career professionals who are in a position in their careers where they have demonstrated some leadership chops but are poised to do something more and just need something to give them that added push, whether it's the training, the network, meeting someone who just has that special sauce that they need to take their idea or their project to the next level. We offer all of those things and more. It's really sort of like, I've heard someone describe it as like an innovation lab where, you know, people get together, bring their ideas, workshop things, you know, take all their tools out of their pockets, put them on the table and build something cool.
Yeah, it's somewhat of a progressive incubator to that point where we are flexible with age. So it's got to be the passion. You have some background and you're still in a point in your career where you can still do some really great work. You're not quite established and there's still more work that you could be doing. So we're kind of helping you and also personally helping you find your focus and your passion. And I think that's one of the greatest strengths. It's very introspective. It gives you the opportunity to kind of look at yourself, figure out what you can be doing, and, you know, get the support to be the best person that you could possibly be and to take that energy and give it back to your community and do that grassroots stuff and build stuff from the bottom up and do amazing things.
And I think, too, that, you know, we have actually had fellows who maybe are already established in one field but want to try something new. Mm-hmm. They want to, you know, really pivot in their career path, and this gives them the opportunity to do so. So, I mean, I guess that's why we don't call it Young Leaders Council, because we do have an age range. I would say that the range is probably 25 to 35, and we do have outliers on either end. It's sort of an X factor, you know, like I said, you've demonstrated some leadership capacity, and it's more that we see that there is potential and that the fellows are really hungry to take all that there is around them to create something. And, you know, it's the X factor. It's really hard to pinpoint, but you know it when you see it.
And I had it. Because I was one of those people that started in one career and now I'm moving.
So you went through the program and now you work there.
Yes.
Uh-huh. That's a testimony.
So they got me. So I was one of those individuals. My background is forensic psychology, forensic mental health counseling. I worked, you know, within the system, criminal justice system, behavioral health system. You know, when I was getting involved with New Leaders Council, it made me recognize that while I appreciated being on the front lines and doing that care providing work, that I could be called to do bigger picture and macro stuff. So New Leaders Council was really important to me because it made me realize that I have an important voice and my knowledge could be used in bigger picture and policy picture. So, you know, it's obviously a transition, but, you know, New Leaders Council can do that for people where they're already established, as Nora said, and need to, you know, get find their calling somewhere else.
Interesting. And so there's 44 chapters nationwide. And how many fellows are attached to each chapter?
Generally 20 per year. And depending on how new the chapter is, the first one was in California, I believe. New Jersey, you were 2009. Was that your first? 2009 was your first year?
We're about 7 years old, I believe.
Okay, so. I think we might have established the same year then. 2010 was our inaugural year. And, you know, our alumni base is approximately 150 now. So it's generally 20 to 25 fellows per year, per chapter. And we have 3,000 alumni across the nation now with the goal of 10,000 by 2020.
Wow, that's a great goal. That's super cool. And how is, you know, as you're talking about progressive leadership and grassroots activism in the community and some of the things you're trying to eradicate, racism, sexism, things like that, those are major themes of this presidential election that we just went through. Did you see a shift in the fellowship, or did you see a shift in focus, or kind of a doubling down, or what did you see during
that? Yes, yes, and yes. Yes. I definitely... very much an uptick in applications. We had record numbers of applications this year, and it made our selections process so much more difficult because, you know, we wanted to keep all of them, but being a nonprofit with limited capacity, you know, and trying to build classes that represent as much diversity in every respect possible from, you know, ethnicity, background, sector, you know, you name it, we want to have the most diverse classes, you know, that we can possibly have. So, you know, it was a really wonderful, it was a great problem to have. But, you know, when you're a people person, like New Leaders Council people tend to be, you hate to turn away anyone who wants to make change in their community. We want to train everyone. So that, I would say, due to the election season, we had a, you know, real surge in interest.
Sure. And you mentioned sector. So there's not necessarily a particular area of focus. People aren't necessarily coming in to make a political change or something like that. They're just kind of different kinds of career changes across the board.
Yeah. And it's not necessarily even career change, but it's, you know, there is certainly in, we are nonpartisan, but there is a political flavor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's, you say progressive and it kind of, you know,
sure,
points to a certain kind of person who, you know, tends to push for people before profits and, you know, working in a social justice and people-centered orientation. But that does not preclude people from, you know, any political party. But yes, indeed, this year, you know, we saw people who are from all sectors, nonprofit, for-profit, education, business, entrepreneurial, lawyers, again, you name it, we want them in our organization, but they do have political interest. So they may want to work on campaigns and support candidates that they believe in. And, you know, they may be more interested in learning how, you know, the fundraising training in particular appeal to a lot of people because more and more people see the value in knowing how to fundraise efficiently and effectively so that they can help their causes and their candidates succeed.
Right before the break, we were talking a bit about kind of the shift in work styles, how it used to be that you found a job and you stayed at that company forever, and then it started to shift to where people were jumping companies more, and now there seems to be this shift of this very DIY kind of, I'll wear five different hats and do a lot of things, and I'm in better shape to be in the driver's seat if I just do all this myself. There's this big change to DIY that I think is really interesting, and I wonder if you've seen that reflected in the fellows that you're working with at your respective chapters?
Big time. It's one of the core tenets of our organization is having an entrepreneurial mindset. And that's what we actively look for when interviewing. It's not a prerequisite to have actually started an enterprise. There's a million different ways to show an entrepreneurial attitude. Basically, what it means is problem solving and creating. And, you know, you're trying to solve a particular problem and you create a solution to do so. And if you can monetize it, well, all the better. And for us in NLC, it's mostly about, is it doing something to help other people or your community?
And that's actually one of the things that's actually really chapter specific, because each chapter actually has its own flavor. So, you know, it sounds like Chicago has a lot of entrepreneurs. And, you know, New Jersey, while we do have entrepreneurs, it skews a little different. There's some people who are, you know, in the legislature. There's some people who do a lot of nonprofit work and policy work. So we have almost more of a kind of policy, political. And we definitely do have, you know, entrepreneurs who start their own businesses, and those who might also be kind of more in traditional roles. They're also involved in other nonprofit organizations on boards, and they start their own nonprofits for more progressive situations and events. So, you know, it's one of those things where each chapter really has its own style and its own flavor.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I like most, too, is, you know, we have the national leadership, and they sort of set the tone and give us the guidelines, but they understand that each chapter, you know, in each region, we all have different problems that we're trying to solve. We all have different constituents in our makeup, so we need to address the problems in our communities, and they give us quite a bit of freedom to do so. So we have the framework to work within, but, you know, we're able to adapt it to suit our own particular regional needs.
Right. So in our chapter, we've made like significant strides to move away from complete political policy circle and, you know, talking to like getting more teachers involved and so on and so forth, because, you know, everyone has a role to play in kind of this progressive movement. And, you know, we all can't be, you know, in the legislature. Sometimes we make our biggest impact, like, on the street or in classrooms. So it's empowering our fellows and our communities to kind of stand up and do what they got to do.
And it sounds like you pay a lot of attention to building on individual strengths, too, because not everybody's going to be a good fit to run for office. Some people are going to just blow it out of the water to be kind of a behind-the-scenes person.
We can't all be a ballerina.
We cannot all be, right, a ballerina or first violin or whatever, right? Someone's got to be the conductor and cello and all those things, right? So, Crystal, you are doing some really interesting things as diversity chair with the New Jersey chapter that's taking on that topic in a really interesting way. Tell us about that, if you would.
I have to be completely honest. I can't take all the credit for kind of the New Jersey chapter diversity initiative. My predecessor is diversity chair, who is actually our current deputy director, Brandon McCoy, was behind the scenes and really pushing for our chapter to be more purposeful when it comes to diversity and inclusion issues, paying attention to what we're doing and how we're doing things and, you know, trying to fill in gaps where we're kind of heavy on different, you know, kind of characteristics like super political, super male, like, you know, kind of what are we really doing? Is this the best way to do the best work? So the diversity chair position is kind of a newer thing. Not many chapters actually have an executive board position that is diversity. I was his deputy last year and I took over this year. So for me, my goal is to be really, you know, assertive and targeted and purposeful when we talk about diversity and inclusion and making sure that's integrated on every single level of our personal organization. So the executive board is being mindful of it in terms of recruitment, in terms of selections. Are we going to different parts in our state? Because unlike Chicago, we are a state chapter. Are we going to South Jersey? Are we going to North Jersey? You know, are we talking to these groups of people? Are we outreaching? And, you know, it's not going to be perfect the first time around. As I tell our fellows in the executive board, none of us are perfect. We make the biggest mistake when we think that we're perfect and we don't have anything to learn. Everyone is kind of crappy. And in the search for that perfection, we become less crappy. And we do better. So, you know, it's...
I want that on my headstone. Yeah. In the search for perfection, we become less crappy.
Yes,
I
yes.
Love that. It's poetry.
So, you know, and that's kind of what we're doing. You know, we're paying attention in selections. Mm-hmm. You know, we're paying attention to who's actually we're getting to do our institute, who's doing our, you know, communications. Are we making sure everyone is shining as much as they can be? And this is in no way like a quota system. It's, mm-hmm. you know, are we being reflective of our state? Yeah. Because our state is just not one type of people. And we're trying to make sure that we are being as reflective as a chapter is our state. And we're going to stumble a little bit. But what I appreciate is that New Jersey chapter, it feels like we're going to take those those bullets, as it were. We're going to try, we're going to fail, we're going to do great things, and we're just going to continue to evolve. So we do a, National has actually set up a diversity curriculum, and diversity curriculum is now mandatory, I believe, across all the chapters. New Jersey, we do, we always like to experiment, so we like to try things, and...
Well, someone's got to.
Someone's
got to
do it.
They try them, and then Chicago's like, okay, cool, let's go,
Jersey. Thanks for working out the kinks, we're just going to take this now.
Right. So, we are... Like this year for our institute obviously our new institute session is starting this month, this weekend for our New Jersey chapter. As part of the institute process, we are going to have a diversity speaker and kind of really focus on kind of the empathy and kind of articulation and learning what diversity is and how we can start addressing our own kind of biases and how we can start having conversations that are uncomfortable. So my biggest thing throughout the institute, I'll be also kind of facilitating little mini exercises, is having uncomfortable conversations and getting our fellows kind of used to it. As I mentioned before, like I am not perfect when it comes to diversity. I am definitely a Black woman, so I guess I have a little bit of a leg up on it, but like, and I have a personal commitment to it, but you know, I still have a lot to learn. I still have a certain amount of privileges. And, you know, I explain that, you know, the privileges I have, I need to work on and, you know, address that. So have these really difficult conversations and start learning and, you know, tear down some of our ego and our pride and figure out how we can do the best work, because we still have a lot of work to do. The progressive movement still has a lot of work to do. And I don't want us to rest on our laurels mm-hmm. because we're like, we're progressive. So we're going to be doing kind of a reading situation. We're going to break them up into groups that have already existed and served other roles. And, you know, they're going to be assigned a book on a diversity topic ranging from race to kind of trans, like mm-hmm. LGBTIA stuff. And, you know, break them down and just assign it to them and like process this together in your small group of four or five. Talk about this, challenge this, figure it out. And, you know, and just keep having those conversations and not shying away for stuff because, you know, not as I said, we don't have all the answers, but we still need to talk about it and work on it.
We're not going to get them if we don't start talking.
No, right. I think that's what progressive means is always moving towards something better. And
right.
It's like reform.
Right. Because like as you're saying progressive, I'm sure, you know, I think we've lost touch of that word. It means progress. That's all, you know, and that's why you're able to say that in the context of a bipartisan organization. It's about moving forward, and part of moving forward is coming together. And I think I was sitting here writing things down, and my face was turning to that little emoji with the heart eyes as you were talking, because you said so many wonderful things. But I think that what you said about when you go into a conversation as if you have nothing to learn, and I think we just saw that on display nationally in such a big way, right? When we were talking about when we were not talking, in fact, bigly not talking about this country and all of the, you know, everything happening politically. It was really fascinating. So I want to shift a little bit and talk about some of the community partnerships that you have, because it seems that you are really working with a lot of organizations as you're working with these fellows and the people that you're working with in all 44 chapters. I love that, thinking of all these people around the country doing all this cool work and becoming better versions of themselves. But tell us about who are some of the other groups that you're working with and aligning yourselves with through New Leaders Council.
You bet. Well, you know, we are always looking for ways to expand our community, expand our reach, to help other organizations, you know, do their work better. And of course, to, you know, look for ways to just advance our mission, too. So some of the partners that we're working with have actually been born out of New Leaders Council. From there.
Someone do the program and come back and partner with you.
Either they, you know, are working, you know, elevating something that they came in to do, their capstones that, you know, we have a capstone component. That's mm-hmm. where you dream up and design a blueprint for the idea of your choice, execute it, whatever it is. You know, a lot of people have taken their capstone projects and, you know, made nonprofit organizations out of them. One of them being Blue 1647, which is a tech incubator and workforce development center, started down in Pilsen, and they now have one in Compton, St. Louis. I think there's one in the East Coast, can't be sure because they're growing so quickly, and there's one in Haiti. So, you know, they're becoming international, and, you know, Blue is great. I'm a member myself. It's a place where you can, you know, it's shared workspace, meeting spaces, go see what people are working on, what they're up to, help your own tech project. They have classes, programs, women in tech. They have programs for kids. It's really an amazing community. We also... Google, Chicago is one of our partners. Ballot Ready, which is an amazing organization. They basically collect as much data and information as they can on candidates, bipartisan, nonpartisan, and they collect the information and put it in easy to read format that you can use on your phone, bring into the ballot with you so you can, you know, go all the way down the ballot and be educated.
I did not votes. Know that was one of your partners, and I was standing in line to vote, and I was telling people because like, I was going like, are you ready to vote down ballot, or are you just, because you need to, those
vote
are things, and I was like trying to get all the people, like I was like saying, I was like, guys, we gotta make sure.
I will talk to them, make sure that they have little cards to hand out, and
yeah.
I mean, since you can't campaign, electioneer, but you can definitely hand out a nonpartisan information resource. So that Amy Guth, you're so smart. And in fact, another community partner of ours is the Center on Halsted.
Excellent.
Why don't we talk about our little, what is our fun story, Amy?
Sure.
Let's talk about that.
Well, so outside of WGN Radio, I have a film production company called Strange Ways, and I wanted to make a point to align Strange Ways with communities that matter to me. And so there is a startup in New York called Video Out, and it's a video platform where members of the GLBTQ community upload their own coming out story. And I thought that was really powerful, and I met the founder, and I really loved his mission and his passion for that. And he was talking about collecting, like jumpstarting the collection of these stories. And so I said, well, why don't I'll host you in Chicago, and we'll do this event and have a day of it, of just filmmakers coming together to collect stories of people willing to share. And it became a thing. And you were nice enough to put me in touch with the folks at Center of Halsted, and they're giving space to the event. And it's January 15th, and I'm super excited about it.
I'm super excited about that, too. I would like to say hello, Jordan, to my co-director of the chapter. He wanted to remind us that our friend John Fakuri, who came on the radio show mm-hmm. with me last time, of Framework Communications, is not just a community partner. John is also on our advisory board. He's a great friend to the organization. We are seeking advisory board members, Amy Guth, advisory board members help to sort of oversee the overall strategy, fundraising, and just making sure that the executive board is steering the organization in the right direction, helping us to acquire resources, and just generally being awesome guidance for us as we continue to grow.
And so if someone listening is interested in being an advisory board member or supporting, or maybe they have an organization that they're going, oh my gosh, this is so aligned with what Nora's doing, how would you like them to contact you?
They can reach us at chicago.nationbuilder.com or nora.gruenberg@gmail.com.
I cannot believe you just gave out your Gmail.
So what? Whatever. I mean, you wouldn't
That's
even
right.
believe the
I
things
know.
That I get. So
oh, I
holler
would.
At
oh,
me,
I would.
Future advisor. Yes,
I would.
Actually, you would. You would indeed. But
right.
Never like that.
And so what about the New Jersey chapter? Are there things that that Chicagoans can be doing to help other chapters, maybe if you have roots in a different city or something like that? Or is there something that Chicagoans could be doing to help the national chapter of this organization? Or is it best to just partner with your local chapter?
I mean, it
I've stumped them.
Yeah. I mean, all of the things are very possible. So, you know, I like to say very cheesily in my chapter that NLC is family. So I really try and to really kind of, you know, in a really, I hope, adorable and endearing way, really drive that point home that we should consider each other family. We're going to share together. We're going to grow together. We're going to do better together. I am just killing it with these slogans tonight, folks. but if we have someone who is moving from a different state, you know, we encourage them to reach out to that chapter and let them know, hey, family's coming.
We embrace them.
That's how do you think I'm here right now?
Well, she landed
it sounds
in Chicago.
Like a fascinating little fraternity and sorority of all the fellows that you have. And do you do you do purposeful things to keep the alumni in touch and creating together?
Absolutely.
We definitely strive to do that. So we have events outside of Institute. Institute is just only one kind of facet of what NLC can really be. We really want to train and promote and help, but it's also kind of accessing a network. And each of us have a network that we bring to the table. And when I say we're family, like, you know, if, you know, my quote unquote cousin can help you with this and, you know, they're on the board of this organization, I'm going to refer to you because I know you're good people. And that's kind of how we help each other.
Well, it's just kind of more formally anyway, doing what we all do kind of anyway, naturally.
Absolutely.
And what I've certainly seen an uptick in that across the board on a range of political ideologies since the election, a lot of people kind of coming together in a different way. And I've said on the station before, the night of the election, I was standing next to a woman and I said, how are you feeling? You know, is the election going the way you want it to? And she said, well, it's too soon to say, but no matter what, tomorrow morning, we're all going to wake up with a roadmap and we're going to know the things that we need to start doing tomorrow. And either way, that's our goal and that's our responsibility. And she said, it's not just, we don't just have the right to vote, but we have the responsibility of being powerful and engaged citizens, which I really loved hearing her. She was the perfect person for me to be standing next to as I was watching the election. She had such a great attitude about the whole thing. Truly.
That's right. I agree with that. I think that is very much aligned with the New Leaders Council's values, you know, that's make a plan. And then execute that plan. Ask for help. Offer to help. You know, take action. Do something about the problems that you see. And don't be afraid. Just get your hands dirty. And once you get started, all of a sudden, you know, things start getting a little bit easier. Once you take those first couple steps, before you know it, you're running.
Yeah. And also talk about stuff. You know, as much as we were talking about how people are miscommunicating, not communicating, mm-hmm. It's also we're not listening. We're not listening to each other, and we're not recognizing where each of us is coming from, so we can find that common goal,
yeah,
and kind of get to the finish line.
Well, I've talked about this before too on the station, but I think this applies so much to this. Is I've talked about the writing of George Lakoff, mm-hmm. who writes so much about our communication styles. He's a linguist, but essentially he's saying how our ability to ignore information if it doesn't align with the framework we've built in our heads, that, you know, we can't make up our mind fresh every single day. That would be a full-time job. So we kind of have this information sort of buttressed in our minds as we go, and our life experiences build them and strengthen them so that we sometimes don't even remember hearing a fact if it doesn't align with that. And I think that's sort of the issue that we are in, and the moment that we're in, is that we play tug of war. Like, I need you to think what I think, and you want me to think what you think. And instead of saying, okay, we're not necessarily agreeing right now, let's find space to talk rather than try to win. And I think that's where I think there's going to be so much to gain when we get to that point. But if you've been on Facebook in the last 10 minutes, you'll see we're certainly not at that point.
Not yet.
Yeah, we still have a lot to do.
My Facebook looks pretty good because I've hidden people that I just...
Because you blocked everybody.
I block nothing. And just unfollow. Still my friend.
You know what?
Yeah, check in on you.
There was only one person that I blocked during the entire election.
That's not bad.
It was because of abusive language and racist slurs. And
yeah,
I was like, okay, that's too far. And it was
that's
like
unacceptable.
But I'm sharing my opinion. I was like, no, you said
no.
Actually, you said a group of people should be dead. So no, we're done. we're done here.
It goes a little beyond expressing an opinion.
But I think it's important to. And I've heard people say, oh, if you voted this way, or if you did X, or think this, unfriend me now. Which that kind of makes me cringe a little, because that's kind of throwing. I was say throwing gasoline in the fire, but it's like, it's worse. It's like widening the chasm between us, you know, and the distance. And, I think it's important to hear a variety of opinions. I think it's important, as you said, to have those uncomfortable conversations.
Yeah. Cause there's going to be some ugly truths and we need to
absolutely
hear them.
We need to hear them. We're not going to get anywhere.
Get used to being uncomfortable. Nobody wants to have conflict and be unlikable for a moment.
It's, right.
You know, it's,
well, I think we're that way. Anyway,
well, you said it first.
Yeah. We've gotten to a spot about where uncomfortable is not supposed to be a thing. Like, we pop an aspirin the minute we feel weird. We, you know, instead of saying, why does my head hurt? Maybe because I'm sitting weirdly. Let's correct that. And nope, I just take a bunch of Advil. You know, we're in that moment emotionally and physically and medically, and it's not good.
We're looking for the easy way out.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I don't go for the low hanging fruit, you know,
but nonetheless, we have work to do, and it's going to involve being willing to be
uncomfortable
and vulnerable and saying, I don't know what I don't know. I only know my experience. I can't know yours.
Right.
We're talking about some big stuff here tonight, nonetheless, but it's important that we do. I understand that you, so you do you have the fellows every chapter, all 44 of them around the country, has the 20 or so fellows every year. And that is just now, that coincides with the calendar. So that's just now starting. How is all of this funded? Is this around donations? Is this a grant underwritten somewhere, or is it all of those things?
All of the above. And one of the central focuses of our training is fundraising. So we train our fellows in the fine art of fundraising, from, you know, developing a plan and figuring out who you're going to reach out to, what is your message going to be, helping to give them the skills to take this, you know, to the next level in whatever it is that they're doing. So the way that they practice this skill is by hosting an annual fellows fundraiser, in which the funds are used to fund the next year's programming. The program itself is free. So, you know, the course itself, no dollars, which is lovely and very rare for a program like this. There are very few leadership training programs that are offered free of charge. So the payoff is when the fellows put on this fantastic party. Every year it's so much fun. We have such a great time. And being able to fund the next year's programming is a very gratifying feeling. So that is, you know, one of the main sources of our revenue. And with, you know, varying levels of success, some of the newer chapters are just kind of figuring it out. And then other chapters like Chicago, you know, we rock pretty hard, but we're going to have to give it up for Jersey. Hey, she's just choking on her own pride over there. No, New Jersey is seriously every year at the national conference. It's, you know, they do the awards and every year it's like, all right, just give Jersey their fundraising awards
because
they smoke everyone like salmon. Tell us a little bit about your special sauce. Tell us all your trade secrets, Crystal.
Our special sauce is he has stepped down, but our old chapter director, Justin Braz, was essentially our special sauce.
Yeah, fundraising superstar.
That kid is magical. But, you know, our new chapter director, Katie Brennan, and deputy director, Brendan McCoy, you know, they have some shoes to fill, but they're gonna do great work. And, you know, we're going to just keep doing what we do in the Garden State.
And so is it the same format that the fellows the party to fundraise for the following
right.
year?
Right. And we also have an advisory board kind of fundraiser, too, to kind of help supplement that as well. So
two parties in Jersey, one party in Chicago.
We like to party. So that might have been.
That's got to be a parties. Thing. Okay, we definitely have parties. But yeah, that's again with the different regions, different flavors, you know, that's every region is going to create sort of a different structure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, their advisory board system is different than ours. Although it's very interesting. They have a vast advisory board. We're building ours a little more slowly, but regardless of the differences, you know, the fact is that it's not just a really, it's an essential skill to learn in life. I mean, before I joined New Leaders Council, my fundraising experience was limited to, you know, the school fundraisers, you know, my kids buying the box of candy. I would eat that candy and then pay it myself. That was not fundraising. So I knew that I really needed help in that realm. So that was one of the things about the training that really excited me. I was like, you know, that's something that I could really use. And it was fantastic. It was a great, you know, hands-on practical application. You know, it wasn't just learning in theory. It was putting it into practice and learning how to, you know, overcome the butterflies in your stomach when you call someone and, you know, explain what it is that you're calling for, why this is so important. And then you begin to realize, you know, one of the trainings, it explains that people, they want to give. They do. They're looking for, you know, organizations and causes to give to. All you have to do is give them a good reason to do it. And a lot of times that reason is you. They like you. They care about you. And you are getting value out of something. And it's, you know, making you a better person. So they'd like to support that. And, you know, I think that it's since it's so intimidating asking someone for money that people forget that, you know, these people love you and care about you. They think that the project you're working on is worthwhile. You just have to ask.
It's the ask. That's
it.
I'm always saying that. I get so many from like PR emails all the way to fundraisers, things. it'll just close with, this is what I'm doing. Thoughts? Question mark. I'm like, you didn't ask. Thoughts on what? What are you asking me? I know what
I'm confused.
Right. Like, I know what you're asking, but I'm a stickler for it. Like, I will force you to make the ask because I know you're asking, you know.
Don't be hinting around.
Yeah. Don't like, guys, we have no time for hints. And I realize I'm kind of a blunt person, but there's no time for hints. You have to just say the thing and come right out with it.
Come right out and say it.
Make the ask. I mean, if you're promoting a thing, just be like, I'm promoting this thing. I would love for you to go, or I would love to come on the radio and talk about it, or I would love for you to tweet about it, or just tell me what you want.
And you can't be afraid to hear no. Just can't. I think that you know, goes back to something we were all discussing earlier is, you know, pride gets in the way of all good things. You're going to get hurt. You're going to hear no. Someone's going to mess up your plans. You've got to just ask anyway. Do it anyway. Don't be so afraid of someone saying no.
So true. And the thing that comes out of someone's mouth after no, or I don't think so, will help you so much. Because it's usually like, no, I don't really care. Whatever they say, you know you can tweak your next pitch to be even better, like to overcome that objection.
Yeah, and once you rip off that Band-Aid, you can just become like a fundraising beast. I mean, that's not my story. It still makes me very uncomfortable. But, you know, I have seen some people in my own fellow class that were just very like unsure. And, you know, now they're just rolling in it. Like they have it down. And, you know, that's...
And then you can train other people in how to do that. And that's, you know, it's a transferable skill. So.
And it's not even necessarily about monetary stuff. Like, it's learning how to just make asks.
Mm-hmm. Which is so key. So key. Yeah. And I love this feeling as you've been talking about New Leaders Council. I love this kind of feeling of, like, teach a person to fish. And that kind of feeling, like, you're setting people up with these really important skills and empowering them to pass those skills on, which I think is so wonderful. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for being here today. Nora Gruenberg from the Chicago chapter and Crystal Pruitt from the New Jersey chapter of New Leaders Council. Where can people go online to find out more about your organization and if they want to donate or keep in touch or all that good stuff?
Well, you can go to newleaderscouncil.org for the whole Megilla. And if you feel like donating $5 million to the Chicago chapter so we can take in all of those wonderful progressives next year when they apply, it is chicago.nationbuilder.com/monthly donor.
That's a lot, but we'll say that again.
chicago.nationbuilder.com/monthly donor.
All those things she just said.
Yes. And also very similar to New Jersey chapter, I'm going to have Nora look up the New Jersey chapter.
We'll tweet it out.
Hashtag we'll tweet it out.
I'm going to get murdered now. But go to the newleaderscouncil.org and you can search for chapters, look for New Jersey chapter, and you can make donations directly to the chapter.
Excellent.
You know, I'll even, you know, if you want to email me at njdiversity@newleaderscouncil.org, that's New Jersey or njdiversity@newleaderscouncil.org, you know, and you want to donate, I will send you links, honey.
There it is. Thank you both for being here tonight from New Leaders Council to tell us all
great.
About Thank the
you
work
so
you're
much.
Doing. Thank you. Thank you both. 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight here on The Download. Thank you for being with us, tuning in and sharing part of your evening with us. You know, we were just talking with Nora and Crystal from the New Leaders Council about the really impactful work that they're doing. And we're just going to keep the amazing conversation going because our guest in studio now is Edna Jacqueline Vasquez, and she is perhaps superhuman is the thing. She has just earned a very, very fascinating distinction. She's an ultra marathoner, which means that it's anything ultra marathon is anything over the distance of a regular marathon. Now, my friends, I have run some marathons and they are very hard. And so the idea of doing more than 26.2 miles makes me kind of want to punch myself in the face. But you, Edna, that's nothing. That's like a training run to you, 26.2 miles. So you've just completed the Four Desert series, which is a really unbelievable accomplishment. It is four ultra marathons around the world. There's one in Chile, one in China, one the Sahara, and then Antarctica. And you've just done all four. Congratulations. You are officially superhuman. I have called it.
Hello, everybody. Thank you very much, Amy, for inviting me. This. Thank you also, David, for having me here this evening. It's a pleasure to stay here. And yes, as you say, it is incredible to see how as a human being we have a lot of strength.
Sure.
To do those type the best.
And so how long did it take you from the first race to the fourth? What was the span of time that you took to do all of these races?
Yes, it's a series, the Four Desert Series, which is the most extreme desert in the world. The test or the race is 250 kilometers, 155 miles.
Each one is 155.
Right.
Guys, 155 miles, and she did it four times is what I'm saying to you.
Yeah, yeah, it's around almost 1,000 miles.
That's amazing.
Well, basically, I started in 2013.
Okay.
I'm currently... practice ultramarathons, and I was doing my last 19 years as an ultramarathoner. In 2013, I completed 100 miles straight.
That was your first?
It was the 100 miles straight in ultramarathon.
Which one was that? Which race was that?
I run in Wisconsin, Gero Marine.
Mm-hmm.
So in ultramarathon, just want to make emphasize, we have a straight and we have also a stage.
Mm-hmm.
So the series that I'm doing or what I completed, it was in a stage. And Atacama is Atacama in Chile is the more arid desert. It's the most arid desert in the world. And I started in 2013. So I run for 7 days.
Right. So we have to make that distinction for people that are maybe not in the ultramarathon world.
Right.
So there's some that you go straight through. Like the Western States is one that
Correct.
I've always thought would be so cool to do.
Correct.
But you go straight through on that thing. You are running all night and all day.
Yes.
And you keep going. But these that you did, these are stages. So you get to stop and rest, sleep, get your mind back together, eat, all of those things, right? But it's essentially like a full marathon every day for a week.
Yes. As you explained very clear, in ultramarathon, we have those type of schools. That's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, in 2013, also, I completed the 100 mile in Kettle. Then after that, I was thinking, like, what else can doing?
Right, because we were like, oh, I just ran 100 miles. How can I make this awesomer?
It's just it's our strength and our preparation and discipline, is testing ourselves. In my case, is just asking myself, what is the next, type of the race or type of the event that I can grow up?
Mm-hmm.
And not just only as a runner, because it's a lot of preparation. And I wanted to do in something that after I finish, like now, the complete series, I can have the ability to, to inspire others, or the same way help to others to doing this type of races. So I just want to emphasize it's in a stage race. And the stage race also we have to do in a cell support. Cell support meaning is I have to carry in a backpack.
Oh, because some ultras, you get someone will come along with you.
Yeah, but this one you have to...
Everything on your back. Oh, my God.
In 7 days, you we have to take at least between 2,000 calories to 5,000 calories. And we just basically bring dry meat, granola bars. In my case, I consume a lot of Parmesan cheese, dry food.
Why Parmesan cheese? Is that just the thing you want when you're running?
No, because Parmesan cheese has a lot of salt
and
fat.
Oh, yeah.
And in fact, running on the desert, the main thing what happened is you get dehydrated.
Mm-hmm.
So prevent all those type the high level of deteriorate yourself,
sure.
Your body. You have to prevent. So we also have to run with electrolytes, which is another technical part that we have to bring in our backpack.
So we're talking way beyond like the Gatorade station on LaSalle during the Chicago Marathon. This is some like next level business. So what is your go-to electrolyte? Is it like the tabs that you put in water?
That's correct. Yeah. Yes, it's a tab, and also bring salt pills.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the main thing that we have to bring. I mean, also it's like the fierce idea to you know, to be ready for any accident or for something sure. that has happened. But basically what happened is in every race, so we met in the middle of the nowhere, basically. Mm-hmm. And then all the organization, they take us in the desert. And the race started in 6 and 7 days. We used to start it in Sunday in the afternoon, and we completed on the Saturday of the following week. And then basically every day we run around 24 and 26 miles from the first day to the fourth day. And between the fifth and the sixth day, we run that ultra marathon, which is 60, 70 miles. And then we completed the week running like the, you know, between the 3, 4, or 5 miles, just only to close the total amount of that 155 miles.
So you have an easy day at the end.
Yes.
That's good.
The thinking here in a stage, I just want to emphasize, is for this instance, when we run a regular marathon, so we start getting, you know, all the fatigue or the pain mm-hmm. or all the difficult part between the mile, 2017, right. something yep. like that. Well, in a stage by running in 7 days, so we feel like in the third and the fourth day. So it is different mm-hmm. because we don't have comfortable things. It's just we run with our backpack, as I explained. And just basically after we finish the race per day, just only we going in the tents. That terrains are very rough. You know,
you're camping on top of
you camping.
Okay, so not only are you running a marathon or more than a marathon, you're carrying all of your food,
yes.
your water, your electrolytes, your first aid kit, and then you're camping. So it's not even like you can go to the hotel and relax after that. You're camping the whole week.
And you don't take a shower.
Everybody's smelling really good by the end of the week. Oh, my gosh. I'm joined by Edna Jacqueline Vasquez, and she has just completed the Four Deserts series. If you do not know what that is, go to fourdeserts.com, and look at it. Because what it is a series of ultramarathons where human beings are put in the most extreme conditions you can possibly imagine, from the Sahara Desert to Antarctica, and you're there and you're doing an ultra marathon. So we're talking about like 155 miles. It is an unbelievable accomplishment. And not only did she do them, she's got her medals with her, which I think is really awesome that you brought all the medals with you. And so that is a huge accomplishment because not many people have done all four anywhere in the world.
There's
I think less than 200 people have done all four.
Yeah, we are just a few people. Before I started the race, I saw that we were 180 person that we completed for at least more of the 100 countries representative our nationalities. In my case, I'm very glad to be part of the first Mexican-American woman or men to complete this extremely races in the world. I'm very excited to talk to you about that because I started in 2013 just with a simple, for me, it was a huge dream. For others, probably it was how you going to spend your time
right.
doing those type of things.
Did you plan on doing all four when you started, or did you just think I'll just do one and see how it goes?
Yeah, it is so, it is so cool to remember this question because I just signed it for Atacama in Chile. And I thought, like, okay, so I'm going to complete this one, and I don't know.
And so that
we'll
one,
see.
The Atacama in Chile, that's like a crossing, so that's like mountainous, right? That's
right.
Hilly. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's high altitude in there.
Sure, which is a whole other thing for running. Like, running in altitude is hard.
Yeah, imagine. I mean, I live in here. I'm here in Chicago, and we are for the
we're like 50
ocean.
Feet above sea level.
Very flat. So, and actually, one of the things that I can remember in 2013, Atacama, they set the race in March, so we were in here with a lot cold. I trained because it was January and February, so I training in the coldest in here in Chicago. But another thing that I doing for training when it's cold in here in Chicago, I running inside to the sauna so I can adapt in my body right away when I get those places.
Oh, that's very smart.
Yes, so. As I say, Atacama was in March. Then I was in 2013 in Gobi, China. Gobi, China, we run close to the Mongolia. Which
so that's mountains too.
Yeah. So in my experience, Gobi was one of the more difficult and technical race, because we started close to the Mongolia mountains, as I say, but also one of the things that Gobi has, it has the most extreme weather.
Mm.
So we started with snowstorms, the first 2 days, then raining, then ice. And then after that, we went all through intro into the canyons. And then we completed with the sandstorm. So,
oh my God. I mean, you start in a snowstorm, end with a sandstorm, no problem. As if, again, as if running 155 miles would not be hard enough. She's done this in a snowstorm and a sandstorm over mountains while carrying all of her food and water on her back and while camping. I'm just saying, I don't dish out the word superhuman lightly, but I kind of mean it right now, because that's a huge undertaking. That's huge. And so how did you mentally prepare for all these?
Yeah, just right now, I just I have memories right now that bring me, oh my God, a lot of feelings. But this time when I talk to you and, you know, all your, they are listening to me, it is very difficult to manage the physical activity, which is our body, and also the mental level of fatigue and pain, mm-hmm. and the difficult circumstances, you know, normal from those places. But how I training, one of the things that I have, and I believe that's the main key that helped me to me, is before the race, or even if it's the marathon, because for me, marathon are painful. To running for 26 miles in concrete is one of the more painful things that I
So you'd rather run 155 miles on mountains than 26 miles in concrete?
It is relative.
Okay, fair enough.
26 miles, you know, it's at least between 4 and 5 hours that mm-hmm. rally is going to be completed. But in those hours, it's suffering.
Oh, yeah.
And then in being ultra marathons, it's suffering also, but it's managed, you know, that time by time. In this case, it's day by day.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, in that third and the fourth day, I'm just in this particular moment, I just remember Gobi. I didn't have all the equipment, my cases, because, you know, when I hear Gobi, I thought like, well, it's going to be almost the same than Atacama. But in this case, it was not like that. So I was running with shorts.
And it was a snowstorm.
And it was, yes.
Oh, no.
So we were like 20s, mm-hmm. low to the 20s. And then the third day, the first and the second day, it was snow. The third day, it was raining with ice. I got hypothermia. And I just say, like, if I cannot, you know, wake up from this one, I don't know if I will be able. So the only thing that I was in my mind is just bring all the best memories. You mm-hmm. asked me for the mental training. One of the key that I use is just bring all the best memories that I can have in my life. For me, it's my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, bring those as my main element to wake up again. And, you know, those memories, they bring me bright and energy. And something happened. It's something very special, you know, too, because you're running marathons.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, boom. It's just like a fly. It's
like being shot out of a cannon,
yeah,
almost.
It's just boom,
like you're suffering and suffering. And then all of a sudden, you just... I know exactly what you're talking about. I don't
just
know what to call it either. It's
go
like
away.
It goes away and suddenly you're on a cloud.
Electricity.
And you can just go. Yeah, it's just like you have this jolt all of a sudden and you can do it and it seems very accomplishable. It's very weird. I thought I was the only person that did that. I'm glad to know you do it too.
So, as I say, Gobi was a very extreme race.
I got to believe, like, up Gobi right there near the Mongolian border, not only is that mountainous, but that's also got to be like kind of treacherous trails too, because that's like a lot of loose rocks and a lot of
yes,
and then you have the snowstorm situation
right,
on top of it. Oh my Lord.
So one of the things that I learned from Gobi, it was get a lot of course strained, but I was very patient.
Mm-hmm.
Patient in my steps, and my pace and keep moving myself. Imagine that's what I, you know, right now in my mind. Like now when it's cold in Chicago and we have to walk.
Yeah.
Walk,
when we force ourselves to be outside.
Until we across the coldest time or the rough times, and then we feel just like freedom, and we just come back and running, jogging and running, running and jogging until we completed the race. So for me, I respect so much the Gobi Desert. It's very extreme. It's unpredictable weather. The directors from the race, they did not manage very precise weather, because, you know, it's something that we can
it's hard to predict
manage,
and
right.
Especially in such an extreme environment, you can't really predict that
so,
weather
right. And however, I was very excited because I get one of my best PR in this race, and I get the first place on my age group, and I was the third woman crossing the finish line.
That's so amazing. I mean, at some point, if you're doing an ultra, I gotta think, at least at the beginning, you're thinking, I just want to finish.
Yeah.
I don't even care if I win. I just want to finish. And now you're like, okay, I've done my personal record and I'm the third woman. All right. That's pretty good.
That's what I feel. I mean, like when I started the race, I don't think, you know, for me, my personality as a runner, the first thing is I commitment with the challenge, with the miles that I have to complete it. Then if everything is going well, I just doing my best.
Mm-hmm. That's all we can do, right?
Right. So I think in my perspective, I always, you know, have this commitment with myself and then compete to other things. But that just was, I do believe that was my key to complete the Four Desert. After I finished Gobi, I was so excited to start the third one, which it was part of the Sahara.
That's a whole other situation. Yeah. We got to take a break. And then I want to talk about this woman who just ran 150 miles in the Sahara Desert and three other really extreme environments. I am so excited about our guest in studio right now. We have Edna Jacqueline Vasquez here. If you do not know who she is, you must go to her website right away. I'm going to tweet out the link. It's ednajacqueline.com. She is an ultra marathoner. She is an international athlete, and she has done amazing things. Most recently, she has completed the Four Deserts series. Go to fourdeserts.com and look at this website because it's unbelievable. Very few people in the entire world have done this, and she has done it. As of the end of November, was it November 30th, you finished the fourth one?
Correct.
Yes. And there it was. And she's brought her medals, and that's so cool. She has all these medals with her tonight. They're like giant and well-deserved. So we've been talking about these four marathons. It's a series, the Four Desert series, in which human beings are put in extreme, extreme situations and weather and terrain and all of that. And we heard about the first two, which is the Atacama Crossing in Chile, the Gobi in China. Very extreme situations there where you got hypothermia and it was snowing and you only had shorts with you. And then there was a sandstorm because, like, that's a lot, you guys. That's a lot. Not to mention you're camping along the way. You're carrying your own food and water and your own first aid. Like, that's a lot. That's enough to, I mean, there's a mental toughness involved in that I admire so greatly, because I think a lot of people would not even attempt, but also I think that would break a lot of people mentally, because that's, I mean, I've done some marathons in my life, and the getting up to the finish line or getting up to the starting line is what's hard physically. Once right. you know, then it's mental. It's all mental. There's a book. I wonder if you've read this book. It's called Why We Run. It is. Have you read that book?
Yeah.
That is so fascinating. If you have not read this book, it is by the author's last name is Heinrich, and he's the winner of the 1981 Chicago Ultra Marathon. As he is writing the book, he's also his own test subject for his PhD dissertation. So he's like trying to emulate things in animals and insects in himself, where he's like, at one point I was laughing so hard because he decides the perfect fuel would be beer. So he stashes six packs of beer open along his training course, but he's running like a 60-mile training course. So he's, you know, 20 miles in and he's wasted because he can't even run because he's so drunk. And it's such a fascinating, but he, at one point in the book, when I knew like there is a certain caliber of person that can do an ultramarathon. The guy gets a knee replacement and just a couple of weeks later does a 40-mile training run to get ready for this ultramarathon that is 100 miles long. And he was doing full marathons just as a warm-up, and he would just keep going past the finish line and just kind of keep running. And so we've been talking a bit about your experiences in these very extreme climates and these weather conditions, and a bit about your training. And I think it's interesting how the human body will tell you what it needs, right? Our brains will suddenly fixate on a thing that we need, or a craving for a certain food or something. And I love talking with runners about the things in the throes of training, when they're really getting into those long miles, like what's that food you need or what's that thing? And that was so interesting how you said Parmesan cheese is like the perfect running food. And you're exactly right. It is.
Yes. Something very magical happened with us when we gone internal after, in my case, after 30 miles. It is more deeply when I'm across the 60 mile, which is 100K. Yes, it is very mental work. And all the physical preparation is help, of course. It's part of to complete this type of the races and ultramarathons or the endurance races. But one of the things that I want to emphasize in my case, it is like alive, you know? Life bring a good things and another sometimes not good. But, you know, we have the opportunity to choose. It's the same thing in race.
Mm-hmm.
So when we are prepared, when we prepare in our body, the physical activity is not always connected with your mental. So you fighting with your mind and say, we have to do, we have to finish, we have to push.
Or we have to stop. We got to sit down.
Right.
Right.
And then sometimes, in my case, in my perspective, I listen what my body say, mm-hmm. but not always. Because if I want completed that race, I have been convincing with myself what I want to do, what I want to go, what I want to across. So it's already on the beginning of the race, what is the dream that I want completed. And, you know, in my particular case, across in these races, as how we spoke for, by Gobi, it was, I can say in there, it was a mental test for me to complete it the 7 days. And now talking a little more about Sahara, which it was in Namibia, Africa.
And that's a very hot climate there. Like you're in a desert. So you've just done these two mountain range ones where you've seen lots of different weather, and now suddenly you're in the Sahara Desert, which is even what people reference when they're talking about a hot day. You're like, oh, it's like the Sahara today. You know, like everybody knows the Sahara is just this hot and unforgiving desert with a lot of extreme temperatures. And I think, doesn't it get very, very cold at night?
Yes, that's one of the particular things that mostly of the desert has. And the beginning of the day, we started probably between 30s, and then going up right away. I mean, I can just bring my mind over there. So it is like 6 at morning, and you feel like 30s.
So it's kind of chilly.
At 10 o'clock, you are in 80s. And then it's up, and then you feel like,
you it's know, like 114 or
yes,
something.
Like you cannot breathe. As I always say, something is magical in us as a human being, because it's that survival need that push us to complete mm-hmm. those races and attending for this instance that you say, what I want to eat, what I can eat and what I cannot eat.
Right.
So this is the particular things that in my case, we have to training. For this instance, I wake up in those races. If we're going to start at 7 o'clock, I wake up like 4 at morning. And I just wake up at 4 at morning to eat. You know, I
and
just
then eat again. And
right,
eat again.
To be prepared
yeah.
to dehydrate it, eat some calories,
yeah,
and prepare at least for the first 5 hours.
I got to think that, especially like in the Sahara, that hydration would be the thing that you're fighting against. That would be, it seems like, because you've got to carry all that water with you. Like, how in the world do you stay hydrated when you're running in over 100 degree temperatures?
It is very
not
technical.
Easily.
Right, it's not like. Easy. So what happened is in our gear, in our backpack, so in my backpack on the side, I carry 2 bottles. So one of the rules is we have to bring between 4 and 6 liters. So I fill it out.
Which is heavy.
Which is heavy.
It's a lot to carry.
Right. So you're talking a little bit before, how is the impact in your back when mm-hmm. you're running? So the impact when you're running with weight is a little more.
Sure.
The only thing in here is if you're training your body with weight, you know, in previous time, mm-hmm. you already, your body is used to.
So how long are you training in advance of an ultra marathon? Is it 6 months?
Or yes.
Is it, yeah.
I prepared in between 6 and 8 months. That's how I did almost one per year. What I'm used to doing is, at the beginning of the year, mostly the races are between March and April. Mm-hmm. So I start training from December to ready for that race, which is in April. And then if I run something else between the middle of the year, I'm just running, you know, to recover myself on my body. Then I used to run local races in here in Chicago, in the Supes, or Wisconsin, or Indiana, or Michigan, which is pretty much the trail what has helped me. I train in here, mm-hmm. and I train pretty much in trails. I wear just technical exercise to have strain my core, my back, which is very helpful in running for a stage.
And as you're training, you're wearing, I assume you're wearing that backpack,
yes,
to get used to all that weight
with
on
that.
You.
And it's so,
I would be so embarrassed.
Yes!
I'd be like, no, not for wearing that, but I would be embarrassed to be like yeah. running a 5K or something, just like slogging along early in the morning for a fun 5K and like, here comes Edna with us. She's like carrying 50 pounds of a backpack, like blowing past me like she's a super comet or something. I'd be like, oh man, I gotta be better. Right? That's awesome. I love that you've done all this. That's so fascinating. And I think the mental part is so fascinating because it really is, you know, I think we dismiss running sometimes. It's just people go, oh, I don't run unless I'm chased. And I mean, I think if you've done it, you know, there is a thing that calls upon your reserves, and the longer the distance and the more you've got to train for it, that there's something in your mind and your emotions that you have to like dig deep to do. That's so interesting. And I love talking with runners about that. Edna, you have just done all four, and that is so awesome. And I'm so fascinated by this process. And, you know, you mentioned something on the break and that I think is really, really interesting, that you're doing all of this around also working. So you have a day job. You do all this is not your yeah. full-time job. How many hours a day are you running when you're training for these? Because we're talking about major distances that you have to do these training runs.
Yes. I have a normal life. I have to work. So I work in a completed shift between 9 and 10 hours. And then what I'm doing to preparing myself for those races. So I split my miles in the day. Sometimes I run morning very early before work. Sometimes at night. Sometimes evening at night. And I find out the way that I can train.
You work it out.
Right. But basically what happened is when I'm in training, which is in about 6 and 5 months, when it's more technical to hit the miles that I have to complete it, I run between 4 and 5 hours per day. We are speaking about 20, around 25, 30 miles per day. And then I run from Tuesday to Sunday. And I have one day of the rest, which is Mondays. And basically it's between Tuesday to Friday. It's around this period between, as I said, 2 or 4 hours. But in the end of the weekend, which is Friday or Saturday and Sunday, I run in there a little more. I mean, they are speaking 8 hours or 9 hours, and I split between 30, 40 miles. And I say if I talking about a plan for 30 weeks, the more intensity of activity is in the last 15 weeks previous to the race. Mm-hmm. And that's how I develop in more the endurance. And then it's when I train in more the technical exercise, which is help me for my core.
Like all the cross training stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So I do pretty much boxing, which has helped me a lot for, for all those type of criteria that I needed.
Boxing and running 5 hours a day. Unbelievable.
The thing is, I don't like lifting weights.
I'm with you on that. I'm with you on
that. But I like activity, a strong activity that helped me. So,
sure.
What
about yoga? Yeah. I'm into yoga. Yoga's good. Yoga helps runners. Well, so when you go to work in the morning, your coworkers are like dragging in, complaining about being tired. And you're like, I've just run 4 hours today.
Yes. I have a very funny experiences because, regular days, I work in a run business in the food industry. And then basically it's, I'm very focused in every activity because mm-hmm. one of the main key as an ultra marathoner and my experience is to care so much the time. Mm-hmm. The time that we need to work, the time that we need training, and the time that we need for rest. So one of those days, some of the guys, they come in and say me, are you the woman who runs those races?
That's me.
And I say, like, how do you know that? Oh, we found it. And I say, well, yes, that's me, and I'm in here working, so we work until we complete it. And one of the things that I just want to emphasize is when we work to developing the endurance helps to different areas of my life. One of the things is for work. One of the main things is for have a concentration, is be focused in one task and start and finish, start and finish. It's very amazing and very bright how we prepare in our mental activity. And I think this is the key to complete the race. You know, if I say that it's 30 weeks, 15 weeks is very technical. So when you get to the race, your body is ready and your mental is ready. You have that convinced time and yourself have that confidence that everything is okay because you're training. It's like when we go into the test, when we were
studied.
In the university,
yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I can say, it's like I have experience that other runners, they used to ask, what are you training? And my perspective is my personal point. I don't like so much talking about what I did or what I would like to reach. I'm very shy person in runner aspect. I don't like talk so much. I'm just be focused what I'm going to do. I need to have this peace in myself. That's my style. I don't like being involved too much just because I like concentrate on all the hard work that I did on the previous weeks mm-hmm. to be on the race. So in my perspective, one of the keys that I also say is training the concentration. Mm-hmm. You're speaking about yoga and yoga discipline, that's how they train or how they have this mental strain. In my perspective and as an ultra marathoner, I develop in every day more and more and more. And it's very amazing how sometimes I don't realize until I see the result all completed or all done. I mean, I just say those races, now I can just see back. I mean, sometimes made me scared. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh my God, that's what I mean. I don't know.
I don't know
if I'm going to do it again.
Sure.
I don't know. Probably yes, probably I don't know.
Well, that was my next question is, what in the world do you do after you've done 4 ultra marathons in such extreme conditions? We'll see, right?
Yeah.
We'll have to wait and see. I want to talk to, I know we're about to run out of time, but the charitable aspect to all of this, because you are a big supporter of organ and tissue donation, and that's been a theme through a lot of your races. You've used that as a platform to talk about all that.
Of course, yes. One other thing also, when I started this particular at races, I also think, well, you know, I'm doing this part of rooting and sport activity, but also what I can do to improve and have other results. So I was blessed from a gift of hope, who they helped me as a sponsor, but also I promoted the tissue and organ donation to our community. And one of the things is just basically realize in athletes and sport areas how it's important from us to, in my case, as athlete, promoting in my sport, but also how I can do it to others be around and also in our groups. It is a bless that I can be part of this amazing organization that helps to all the world to have better life and help to others to continue and live.
And what is the organization if someone wants to donate to it?
Gift of Hope.
And you can go to giftofhope.org.
Of course.
To go there.
And go in and see what is the different programs. And if somebody is interested to be part of that, you know, we are in here to give all the information, and we can help to others to continue their life and living in here.
Amazing.
Our word.
I hope you write a book one day, because you have wonderful stories, and I wish we could sit here and talk all night. Amazing stories. And again, congratulations on this unbelievable accomplishment. I cannot wait to see what you do next. I'm going to follow you on social media and all of that good stuff. But give us your website one more time so everybody can go. You have wonderful videos, and you have a video on Facebook of the snowstorm you were talking about earlier. So everybody should go find that and see them, because they're wonderful and fascinating.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's in www.ednajacqueline.com, and I'm on Facebook by Edna Jacqueline Vasquez, and Twitter, and also on Instagram. And the last thing that I just want to say, Antarctica, it was one of the more amazing places in the world I've ever been.
I'm sure.
It is, for me, it was a bless. I don't know when I will come back.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I want to say, that all the dreams there can be true. And
you're
thank you.
Make me cry.
Yeah, I'm crying here.
So inspirational. Again, congratulations on this amazing accomplishment. And I'm going to follow you on social media and watch to see what you do next, because it's fascinating. Again, go to the website. It's edajacqueline.com. I'll tweet out this link and we'll have it on the WGN radio page also.